Mihaiha of the Federal Facilities Reuse and Restoration Office, who will kick things off. Emmy?
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. One thing before we get started with the actual content of today's webinar, I'd like to talk about the Federal Facilities Academy. So the Academy essentially is a series of webinar and one in-person class that we encourage people to take all of them to be able to receive a certificate saying that you've gone above and beyond in training to better understand CERCLA cleanups at federal facility sites. So it's 11 online webinars and then one classroom delivery of a three-day course. As we mentioned today, for the online webinar, you can receive a certificate of completion once you submit that feedback form. And then the in-person classroom training that you attend in person is open to EPA, states, tribes, and other federal agencies. It's not, unfortunately, open for contractors at this time. If you take that course and all the online webinars, then you can get, again, that certificate of completion for the entire program. This is entirely optional. It's just a way we're trying to encourage more people to get more information on how to do cleanups at federal facility sites. We've offered a couple of webinars so far. I believe this is the fourth one that we're offering in this series of 11. We have a couple more coming up that we'll share at the end of today's webinar, just as a heads up, if you'd like to join us for those. Again, really highly encourage participation in the Academy. So with that, we'll go ahead and start switching gears into the slides of what we're going to go over today. While that's loading, keep in mind that there is a participant manual for this course, so you're not having to try and write down everything that you hear. The participant manual has all the slides and then notes associated with each slide, so that way you can really follow along and listen, and you don't have to get too caught up in trying to capture everything that you're writing down. And I just find them as a useful reference guide after taking the course to go back and see, oh, what was that one thing we discussed? Oh, let me see the participant manual. So highly recommend you download that. Maybe some of you already have it printed out. It's really helpful to follow along for the webinar itself. So plugging that, let's go ahead and get started with today's content. We are looking at RCRA and CERCLA integration at federal facility sites, and we are focusing on those sites listed on the national priorities list. Non-NPL sites typically have a different approach, but we'll talk about that today. So for an overview, we're going to provide background information on what is RCRA and what is CERCLA. We'll look at a legal lesson where the roles of each of these really came to light. Then we'll switch gears looking at how federal facility agreements really lay out the roles and responsibility for each of these programs at a federal facility site. Lastly, we'll go over existing guidance on this topic to help clarify how are we supposed to really do this. And last, some real-world case studies to try and bring it all together and show how this can play out in a real-world setting. Another thing, again, you can enter your questions in the Q&A box as we're going through the slides. We will be pausing throughout to entertain questions, so we'll try and answer them as we go instead of waiting all the way to the end. So keep that in mind as we're going through today's slides. All right, so before we jump into slides and bullets and all that, we'd like to get a better feel for who we have participating in today's webinar. So we'd like to do a group poll, and I'd like you to think about, is it possible for RCRA and CERCLA to be successfully integrated at federal facility sites? So this is an open poll, meaning you can type in a little bit about any experiences you've had, good or bad. Have you been part of a successful integration? Has it been terribly difficult to do so? Or are you don't really know a lot, but you're trying to learn more? If you want to go down to that group poll area, there's a little box where you can type in your information, and we'd love to see what your responses are. Abe, did you want to walk them through that?
Sure. Just in the bottom left of your screen, there's that rectangular box, and you can just free type and discuss any experience that you have had with integration of RCRA and CERCLA at federal facilities, and click the send button, and as responses pop up, you will be able to upvote the ones that you like. So those come up to the top of the screen. So if you have anything to say, just go ahead and click it in that rectangular box. See, we have like somebody with several sites with this issue. Anybody else?
Hopefully people are able to type in. We're getting a little bit of feedback that the box is freezing, so hopefully you're able to type in your answers. Okay, we have a couple different ones coming in right now. People saying, yeah, yes, we've been able to successfully integrate. Another saying it's not easy to do so. We've had problems getting responses from RECRA. Again, I have this issue at several sites. There's a couple of votes for the it's not easy, and I can definitely appreciate that. Also, some agreement on having this challenge at different sites. And then, let's see, some people with limited experience on how RECRA and Circle can be integrated, so they're here to learn more. Wow, the it's not easy is getting the most votes, so I understand why you're joining today's webinar. That's true. I would say it's not always easy, but we're going to lay out some tools and approaches that hopefully will help make it a little easier. All right, a couple more still coming in. People with like decades of experience participating on today's webinar. That's awesome to see. A couple of people listing their specific sites where they've had some challenges, RECRA permitting challenges. So a whole lot of different topics. Communication challenges across the different regulatory programs. Okay, yeah, this is all really helpful. Thank you for sharing with us what some of the challenges you've had so far. A couple of people said, yeah, we've been able to do this successfully at our site, but it's often the challenges, the issues or problems that get a lot more attention, right? The success is like, okay, we did our job, let's just proceed. So thank you everybody for sharing. Hopefully we'll be able to answer some of these questions as we go through today's material. So we're gonna go ahead and continue on to the next slide. All right, so I wanted to start off with a bit of an overview. What is RECRA and what is CERCLA? So with RECRA, we have, again, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, passed in 1976, and it's a regulatory program. The whole purpose of it being passed was to deal with the challenges we had with municipal industrial waste. You know, there's huge health and safety concerns. If these aren't managed correctly, we had to do something to ensure that our waste was being disposed of in a safe manner. So we got this cradle-to-grave approach for regulating waste through RECRA, and it also includes corrective action for releases and past practice sites. Essentially, it's an approach to manage solid and hazardous waste at facilities that are currently in use, as well as those past practice sites. We'll talk a little bit more about what past practice means in just a second. So when we look at CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, that's more of a response program. It's focusing on the management and remediation of abandoned and non-operating sites that have media contaminated with hazardous substances. And this was passed in 1980, largely in part in reaction to what happened at Love Canal. Hopefully everyone on the webinar is aware of what happened at Love Canal. If not, highly recommend Googling that and checking out the videos associated with it. Essentially, we had barrels and barrels, you know, many hundreds of barrels of chemical waste buried in the soil, and eventually that land was sold and developed with schools and neighborhoods and whatnot, and that obviously did not end well. But we realized we need to have a response program to be able to react in situations where we have releases like this one that pose a big threat to human health and the environment. So this is where we get CERCLA. So if we have RECRA and CERCLA, these aren't competing regulatory programs necessarily. Ultimately, that common goal of protecting human health and the environment is shared between these two programs, and there actually is a lot of similarities, particularly with the CERCLA process and the corrective action process under RECRA, which we're going to go over in the next two slides. There's a ton of overlap, so there's a lot of opportunity to really help ensure that these programs can work together or be integrated to work together versus being dual regulatory programs. So let's look a little bit more about how they are similar. So we'll go to the next slide. This figure is actually adapted from a DOE figure that looked at CERCLA and RCRA corrective action. So it's color-coded to help show the similarities in the process. So yes, one's RCRA, one's CERCLA, but they are very similar. And this is going to be important for a number of points we'll make later on in the webinar. But for now, let's step through this diagram together. So we, under CERCLA, we start with site discovery. That's shown in the orange box. Let me see if I can get my arrow here. There we go. The site discovery. And once the site is discovered, that has to be listed on the federal facilities docket. Under RCRA, that comes through a permit application or discovery of a lease, and that goes to the RCRA 3016 reporting. So after the site is essentially discovered, then the next step is determining is some kind of immediate or interim action needed. Under CERCLA, you would look at a removal action. Is the removal action needed? If so, then you would conduct that removal action. This can actually occur at any time in the process, not just after site discovery. In RCRA, you have your interim measure required. You ask that question. If so, then you implement that interim measure. Once you've dealt with any urgent or immediate concerns, you can look at doing a preliminary assessment or a PA under CERCLA, and a site inspection. Then you see in the coordinating purple boxes, that's a RCRA facility assessment. We continue on from that point under CERCLA, you would do a hazard ranking score, and if it scored high enough, then you would continue on with potentially listing that site on the NPL. If the HRS score is too low, then perhaps you could do cleanup under a different regulatory program, and you would look at other authorities then to do cleanup. Or you could decide to continue with cleanup under CERCLA, but it would be at a non-NPL site. So your lead regulator might be the state working with that lead cleanup agency. So when you have a site listed on the NPL, there is a requirement that a federal facilities agreement be issued for those sites. So that's where you land. When you come down to RCRA, corrective action process, you did your facility assessment. You look whether or not that a corrective action is required. If not, also you could look at doing it under different authorities. You implement cleanup under that. If you do need to implement that corrective action, then you would have a permit modification or a 3008 order, which would result eventually in a federal facilities compliance agreement to help guide that cleanup. So again, my biggest point here is that they're different programs, but there is a lot of similarities in the approach and the process. Finishing off the second half of this process, under CERCLA, you would have your RIFS, the Remedial Investigation and Feasibility Study stage, which you're doing a lot of site characterization, data collection, to help develop those all screening of alternatives and ultimately a detailed analysis of alternatives that will be considered when cleaning up the site. Under RCRA, it's a facility investigation or corrective measure study. You would do, again, the same scoping of that work, collecting of information to develop those alternatives. And then you get into, here in the purple again, remedy selection. Under CERCLA, that's a proposed plan, ultimately leading to a record of decision. In a corrective measures selection, you would have that identified in a permit modification or a 3008 order. Finally, you'll get to remedy implementation under CERCLA, and that will lead to your remedial design and remedial action. With corrective measure implementation, you still have to design what you're going to do and implement it, eventually leading to a certificate of completion, a final permit modification, and if needed, any O&M required for the site. And under CERCLA, that would hopefully eventually, right, lead to a deletion from the NPL, conducting any five-year reviews as needed if waste is left in place at levels that pose a risk, and continuing with O&M. So all of this, stepping through this entire process to show there's a lot of similarities. Moving on, or I guess before we move on to the next section, we want to pause for a second and just see if this is sinking in. So we're going to have a little quiz. We like to call it Apply Your Understanding. And here we're asking, what is the main cause for disputes and the lack of integration between CERCLA and RCRA in determining how a site should be cleaned up? So you're going to check all that apply. And I can see people are already beginning to fill out their votes. So we'll give you a minute to do that. I still see some votes coming in. I think I said it was select all that apply. This is just, I think, just a single answer you can submit for this one. All right. Few more trickling in, but looking at the responses, let's go over what the options were. A, CERCLA site managers are generally incorrect. B, CERCLA and RCRA are incompatible. We had a few votes for that one. Professional judgment for C. And D, RCRA site managers are generally incorrect. So some of those are just generalizations, right? This all CERCLA site managers are wrong or all RCRA site managers are wrong. Though not the answer we were looking for. It really comes down to C, professional judgment. That can make a huge difference on how you integrate these two programs, how they're approached, the way the team is able to work together to identify how to navigate the regulatory program really comes down to professional judgment, and that's almost a gray area, right? When it's black and white, it's easy to know what the right answer is. But in professional judgment, it takes a lot more communication to understand what the needs are, what absolutely has to be met as a regulatory requirement, and where the flexibilities are. So we really want to help identify where are those flexibilities? Where is there more than one way to do something to get ultimately to that holistic cleanup that we're all looking for? All right, so we're going to go ahead and continue on. Our next topic is looking at a legal lesson from, then this is a real life situation that we wanted to go over to show how RCRA and CERCLA really got laid out at a site. Okay, so this is looking at a case from 1989 between the state of Colorado and the U.S. Department of the Army. So first, let's look at the site. It's Rocky Mountain Arsenal, RMA, and in 1942, RMA was established by the U.S. Army to manufacture chemical warfare agents and munitions for World War II. So a lot of operations going on there. You can see in the graphic, here's the Denver International Airport, and not too far away, at least relatively speaking, is Rocky Mountain Arsenal. So there's a lot of history here and when and how this site got listed to the NPL, which happened in 1987. The site was originally proposed for the NPL in 1984, and in that proposal, most of Rocky Mountain Arsenal was proposed to go on the NPL, with the exception of an area known as Basin F, which was essentially a lagoon for waste. And that was a RCRA-regulated land disposal unit. At the time, in the, you know, this is the mid-80s, it was EPA's policy that if there were land or if there were units regulated under RCRA, that they would not be included on the NPL listing. They'd be excluded. So that proposal went forward in 1984. Then in 1987, when the site was actually added to the NPL, it also included a proposal to include Basin F, just include the entire site. So keep that in mind because it's going to play a part as we go through how this all played out in court. Eventually, 1989, the Federal Facilities Agreement for the site was signed. It had a number of signatories. Army, Shell Oil Company, who had been leasing land, also signed it. EPA, Department of Interior, DOJ, the Department of Justice, and even ATSDR, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, all signed off on this FFA because the land had been leased to private companies over the years as well. So we have an FFA. We have a site listed on the NPL. As part of that listing, this proposal to expand the site to include F Basin was put out. So what's the problem? Like, here we go. So Colorado actually asserted numerous complaints against the Army under its hazardous waste regulations for groundwater monitoring. And it was difficult because both Colorado and the Army claimed jurisdiction over F Basin, saying that they had jurisdiction and control over the cleanup of that toxic waste holding basin. So Colorado claimed jurisdiction over cleanup under RCRA, but the Army was saying, well, we're doing this cleanup under CERCLA, so state, you can't come under RCRA and interfere with our cleanup. We have this pathway. You can't come and tell us that we have to do something else. Well, that went to a federal court, and their decision was issued that just because a federal facility is being cleaned up under CERCLA, that doesn't mean it's immune to state enforcement actions under RCRA. So the Army had tried to claim sovereign immunity from the state's complaints, from Colorado's complaints, and that did not fly in court. So here is an excerpt from the opinion that was given by the district judge in 1989, and I highlighted what I thought was the pertinent part. So basically saying, you know, the intent is clear. Federal facilities like Basin F are subject to state and local requirements as long as they're applied uniformly. And having found that Colorado regulations satisfy these standards, I conclude that the Army's motion to dismiss based on this argument must be denied. So that was that. No, you are not immune to the state's enforcement actions, Army, and you're going to have to deal with that. So that was the decision given. So what does that mean? In a nutshell, it means that the states may enforce their day-to-day hazardous waste management laws at CERCLA sites. It also means that just because a site is placed on the MPL, that doesn't preempt state enforcement. And lastly, that RCRA is more than just an ARAR. It's, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in the next couple of slides. It's not optional, especially when it comes to these hazardous waste management laws. These can be enforced at a federal facility. There's no way to get out of that or be exempted from that based on this decision. So that's fine. But the decision didn't say how integration would occur. So that's the bigger question. Like, okay, so CERCLA applies, these hazardous waste management laws apply, but how do we implement them at these federal facility sites? Well, a number of memos and policies were issued to further clarify this question because there were a lot of questions on the topic. So we're going to pause for a second and have another apply your understanding. And we're going to bring up the poll so you can go ahead and start answering. This one is a select all that apply. And the question is, when implementing a CERCLA response action at a federal facility, and then you have a couple of options there to pick from. And again, select all that apply. A, RCRA can be considered an ARAR. B, state hazardous waste laws do not apply. C, CERCLA overrides state hazardous waste laws, and D, state hazardous waste laws are enforceable at CERCLA sites. So I see we have a lot of answers coming in, beginning to slow down a little bit, but the answer to this, just based on the lesson we learned from this RMA example, was A, RCRA can be considered an ARAR, and D, state hazardous waste laws are enforceable at CERCLA sites. So that's great. We had pretty much everyone who filled out the poll voted along those lines, so that's great. If you didn't, that's okay. We're here to learn, and again, you can type in your questions in the Q&A box, and we'll try and answer those as we go along in today's slides. So I'm not seeing questions quite yet, but we will come back to the question section in after our next set of slides. So we're going to go ahead and switch gears a little bit to federal facility agreements. Rob, do you want to introduce yourself and take over from here? Rob, you might be on mute. I don't hear you.
Hey.
There you go.
I turned on my webcam too, so see me there.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to talk about federal facility agreements, roles and responsibilities. I'm Rob Pope. I'm an RPM in Region 4 that works on federal facilities, and right now I'm the acting section chief over the DOE coordination section for Region 4. So Amy talked about this earlier in the slide deck, that Circular 120 does require federal agencies to enter into an interagency agreement. Normally, in facilities, these are called federal facility agreements, although they are called some different names in other places. I know out of Hanford, I believe they call it the tri-party agreement. And this is with EPA for remedial action at the federal facility once it's placed on the MPL. Federal facility agreements provide this technical, legal, and management framework under which everything that we're doing for cleanup at the federal facility is conducted. So it's a framework. It doesn't often have all the details we need to get things done, and we have to go look at other guidance on how to do that, CERCLA guidance, and sometimes we're even looking at state guidance and DOE or DOD guidance. But it does specify also who is responsible for what and when they're responsible, so there's a schedule in there. And it includes the federal facility's responsibilities as lead agency. So this is a different concept, that the federal facility is its own lead agency, but that's how it's set up in CERCLA and the National Contingency Plan, the NCP. And also, very importantly to the discussion we just had that Emmy was leading, clarifies how CERCLA and RCRA corrective action will be implemented and how they'll be integrated. So federal facility agreements are enforceable. They're authorized to impose civil penalties for refusal to comply through CERCLA. So in the private site world, we use things called consent decrees and agreement orders on consent, also called consent orders. The federal facility agreement is kind of a version of those, except on a private site, when you're dealing with a PRP, you need a potentially responsible party, a PRP. You need to have a consent order to get the investigation done, and then you move to a consent decree to get the remediation actually accomplished, the design and the remedial action. A federal facility agreement spans all of that for a federal facility, and it tells us how we do those steps. Now, according to CERCLA, we're supposed to enter into these within 180 days of EPA's review of the very first RI and FS, Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study, on a federal facility. I say the very first one because most federal facilities have anywhere between 5 and over 100 operable units, depending on the size and the complexity of the site. So, you know, if you waited till you reviewed them all, we still wouldn't have federal facility agreements on most of our sites. But after you review the first one, you're supposed to start your 180-day clock. Generally, EPA policy is to try and enter into the FFA before the RIFS, so we try to do that. You can do a two-party or a three-party FFA, but typically we get our states to sign our FFAs. We want them to be our partners in regulating the federal facility. We want to make sure that as we move forward, we integrate the state requirements with the EPA requirements, and we'll get into that a little bit more as we go along here. And I think at this point we have FFAs at all of our federal facilities in the country, except for in Region 4 we have one where we have not yet been able to negotiate a federal facility agreement. So the FFAs, we came up with this model language in 1988 that was agreed to between EPA and DOE. It had this section called statutory compliance and RCRA CERCLA integration. That is also carried on into, we had later model language that EPA negotiated with DOD multiple times, and the last version was where the Fort Eustis Federal Facilities Agreement was put together, and so that's the Fort Eustis model is what's referred to for newer FFAs. But you can see, so the first model language between EPA and DOE was back in 88, so that's captured in almost all FFAs. Well, by 2009, we didn't have very many FFAs left to do, so just a few of the newer FFAs across the country have this DOD model language from Fort Eustis. And there's a span in between 88 and 2009 where we have some deviations from model language as EPA and mostly DOD were trying to work out model language to be used. So there's a couple iterations of model language. But all of them have this RCRA CERCLA integration section. This section was designed to identify the requirements of each program and try to minimize duplication. And it's usually a fairly generalized section that just says the signees of this agreement, the EPA, the state, and the federal facility, be it DOD or DOE or whoever it is, agree that things that we do in CERCLA will try to capture in RCRA as well, and they will count for RCRA. And we're going to have a couple of case studies where we talk about how we try to do that. And also, vice versa. If you do something in RCRA and it takes the place of doing something in CERCLA, you can certainly count it in CERCLA. Now, the day-to-day waste management requirements are excluded from integration. Those are on the books, hazardous waste laws. They're independent and outside of the cleanup. And there are a lot of permits that a lot of these federal facilities have that have nothing to do with the cleanup going on, really. They're, you know, if they have air emissions for their operations or they have NPDES permits for their surface water things that are released from the site that are just operational, those aren't really part of the FFA. So day-to-day waste management, those sorts of things are not part of this integration. They're independent. So we have an example from Travis Air Force Base, the 1989 Federal Facility Agreement. So this is one of our older ones with this older model language. This FFA was signed by a larger group than you always see. Sometimes it's just the state represented by one bureau or one division of the state, and just the EPA represented by the region, and just the federal facility itself. But this one was not only signed by the Air Force Base and the EPA, but within California, there was the Department of Toxic Substances and Control and the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Board. And that has to do more with how California has their environmental regulation broken up. So here are the clauses from the Travis Air Force Base Federal Facility Agreement. In Section 17.1, it says that we're going to try to satisfy both the RCRA and RCRA regulatory requirements. In 17.2, it says remedial actions will be protective and no additional corrective action under RCRA will be necessary. And in 17.3, it says permits for actions under the agreement are not required as provided for and CERCLA in the NCP. And we're going to talk about that last little bit. All right, first we're going to apply your understanding here. So you want to click off on everything that's true and let us know which ones you think are true. So which of the following are true regarding FFAs? Do they provide the technical, legal, and management framework under which the response to the federal facility is conducted? Do they require state signature? Are they enforceable and authorized to impose civil penalties for refusal to comply through CERCLA? And D, last of all, must they follow the model language provided in the 1988 model FFA or the 2009 model FFA? All right, looks like we're getting some results. I think we're there. So most of you did click up on the right things, A and C. They provide that framework to do all the work that's needed at the federal facility, and they are enforceable, and they are authorized to impose civil penalties. And that has happened at certain sites with certain federal facility agreements. However, they don't require state signature. So B is false. We do try to negotiate them with states and make sure the state's included. But you can do them and only have a two-party FFA. And you don't have to follow that model language. So a lot of FFAs, will have pieces of them that aren't exactly like the model FFA language. And some of that's because you have site-specific differences. You have waste-type differences. You have things that were already going on at the facility that are addressed in a different way. So you don't actually have to follow that language, but it is the model language that we try to set up, and we try to make sure our FFAs match that model language. But
Yeah, Rob, I'll just add, I don't know exactly which states they are. I think there's about five that it's their policy not to sign an FFA. So it's not always for a lack of being able to negotiate. Sometimes it's just the stance that the state takes that they want to, if they're going to enforce anything, it'll be under their own regulations that they have authority for and not through an FFA. It just depends on the dynamics at your site.
Okay. Yeah, I think all the states in Region 4 have generally signed on to federal facilities agreements, so all of our eight southeastern states. Let's see, there was something else to say about that. That what we do see a little difference in, though, is even with our federal facilities agreements, when it comes to signing the record of decision, this is a little different topic, but they don't always sign the record of decision. They often just want to concur on it, even though they did sign the federal facilities agreement. So that does vary from state to state.
Good point. No, that's true. All right. So before we get into the next topic, I wanted to pause and answer a couple of questions that have come in. So one question we got says, I still don't understand how one can determine if the contamination falls under CERCLA or RCRA. So when looking at federal facility agreements, that can sometimes help to clarify that answer as well, because it'll specifically say what parts of the cleanup are going to be done under CERCLA authority, which are going to be done under RCRA via permit or corrective action process. So you can look at your FFA for some of those answers. Again, it's one of those situations where it's not black and white what the answer is. If you're already dealing with a permit, then you're in RCRA space more likely. If your site is listed on the MPL and there's ongoing CERCLA actions, then you're likely in CERCLA space, but it can determine on the specifics of your site. Rob, did you have anything you wanted to add on that question?
No, not really. I think you pretty much covered it all. If you have an MPL listing, then it's pretty much, we try to do a CERCLA cleanup and just make sure it meets the RCRA standard. So I usually don't get into a back and forth of whether it is under a RCRA or a CERCLA. We do a CERCLA cleanup that tries to meet the RCRA standards.
Yeah, and the policies we're going to talk about discuss how to try and divide responsibility at the site. So that can help answer that question up front so you're not fighting over it or struggling with it throughout cleanup. And we'll go over a few guidances in just a second. There's another question on here. Does RCRA have authority to oversee munitions cleanup? So as far as munitions go, CERCLA is the preferred approach for dealing with those types of cleanups. DOD does have its MEC program, Munitions and Explosives of Concern, and they do their cleanups at federal facility sites under CERCLA 120. So again, a preference for CERCLA there. But it can vary. There might be an instance where you would use RCRA authority to do a cleanup for munitions, but the general rule of thumb is we try and do that under CERCLA. But there's other authorities that might have to be considered also, Safe Drinking Water Act, Clean Air Act, state Superfund laws, or state RCRA programs. Those are all authorities that might have to be considered as well. So not a clean answer, but I would say CERCLA is the preferred approach for munitions. And we'll pause for questions. We'll come back to those questions in a second. So again, keep typing them in if there's something you'd like to ask. And we'll continue on with this next part of the webinar, which is looking at a 1996 memo on coordination between RCRA corrective action and closure and CERCLA site activities. All right, so in this 1996 memo, there's a couple of main points, which is all trying to get at trying to eliminate the duplication of effort, streamline the cleanup process, and build effective relationships. And it includes acceptance of decisions made by other remedial programs. So if a decision is made under CERCLA, that be sufficient for RCRA and vice versa. A deferral of activities and coordination among RCRA, CERCLA, and state and tribal cleanup programs, and coordination of specific standards and administrative requirements for closure. So the whole main point of this is let's try not to duplicate our efforts. Let's try and have the most efficient use of time and resources when looking to implement these programs. Again, the gist I would say is the memo generally states that any cleanup under RCRA, corrective action, or CERCLA will substantially satisfy the requirements for both programs. So there's nothing left to do or to go back and do again at the end of that cleanup process when you're actually done. So I want to talk a little bit more about program deferral and what does that mean, because we get a couple of questions at headquarters on this topic. So program deferral can be a very efficient way for both CERCLA and RCRA to address overlapping cleanup requirements. So RCRA and CERCLA site managers can defer cleanup activities for all or just a part of the site, understanding that cleanup is not required by the deferring program. So if CERCLA defers to RCRA, that whatever the cleanup decision and process that is gone through will meet the substantial requirements of CERCLA as well, so that we're not having to do it twice, essentially. I think if you're a lead cleanup agency, you want that sense of you're doing the cleanup, and when you're done, you're done. There's not going to have to be a need to go redo it because some standard wasn't met or something was left off the table that needs to be addressed. Ideally, you want to make sure that all the requirements are met depending on which regulatory approach is used. So that deferral, when you're saying, okay, we're going to use this program and it's going to meet the needs in all these areas of overlapping cleanup requirements, because essentially we want a good cleanup, we want that protection of human health and the environment, that could work together to make sure we're using our resources across all the different groups and agencies involved as efficiently as possible. So what about when the requirements do not overlap? Then we're looking more at coordination between programs. There are some times when there are just differences in the programs where their requirements are not going to overlap with each other. For example, CERCLA doesn't address petroleum spills, and RCRA doesn't cover radionuclides. So in those instances, the requirements are not overlapping, so you're going to have to coordinate between the two programs. This is where we reference those federal facility agreements and crafting them in a way so that the cleanup responsibilities are clearly divided, and it'll say which parts of the site are going to be cleaned up under CERCLA and which are going to be cleaned up under RCRA. And it's really important in coordination that you look at timing, establishing those timing sequences so that you don't go through one process and then have a huge delay or bottleneck at the end to go back and double check or redo aspects of the cleanup. Ideally, these would be sequenced out, and you could even use like a co-regulator approach to make sure that the parties stay informed and work together, stepping through the process so that there's no surprises or there's the opportunity to weigh in on those areas where, again, the requirements are not overlapping, but you have to make sure that this gets addressed through the cleanup process. So first, you want to look to divide responsibilities, doing that through your FFA, and then secondly, look at timing of those sequences when the overlapping requirements are just too different and different needs have to be met. Again, that co-regulator approach is helpful in making the best use of time and helping everyone stay aware of the progress and working together for cleanup at a site. Another thing that this memo talks about is RCRA closure and post-closure. So this is actually where some of the most significant challenges or issues in integration arise. There's regulatory distinctions between closure requirements under RCRA and other cleanup activities, and that can lead to challenges in resolving those issues. So a CERCLA cleanup plan that includes a RCRA-regulated unit could be structured to comply with both CERCLA and RCRA closure and post-closure requirements. So you make sure that all the boxes can be checked essentially. For example, if you have a RCRA permit or order, it could cite an ongoing CERCLA cleanup and then incorporate the CERCLA requirements by reference. So you still have the permit. It's referencing this cleanup that's going on, and you can make sure that those closure requirements are being addressed. But this is, I mean, I'm saying it like it's easy. This is a really huge challenge and where we see a lot of disagreements and need for communication and working together across the site teams to address these kinds of issues. That dual regulatory structure really remains in place. And just trying to work together in the best way possible to make sure that all the requirements can be met without having to extend schedules or do double work. So another challenge that we have is with RCRA closure and cleanup levels. Again, this is not a simple solution on this topic, but there have been inconsistent cleanup levels for removal and decontamination that we could potentially resolve by using risk-based levels only. What happens is that in some clean closure requirements, they're being set at background for those levels, the clean closure levels, but CERCLA doesn't typically clean up to background. Usually it's based on a risk-based number that's considered safe or protective of human health and the environment. So we have this disagreement between cleaning up to background and cleaning up to address risk. And if we could use risk-based levels, that's what's really encouraged in clean closure, because getting all the way down to background might not always be feasible for a site. Some states have insisted that their closure requirements be addressed outside of cleanup because the closure requirements didn't arise due to cleanup, meaning they don't come under that CERCLA 121E1 permit exemption. That exemption that basically says you don't need to get a permit to do work under CERCLA. It says, well, this is outside of that, so you have to meet these requirements. Again, the biggest thing I can suggest here is communicating across your site teams on where the flexibilities are, where they are not, and looking at what the different programs can do, because the bigger picture is getting to a good cleanup, right, a protective cleanup. How can we do that? But these are not, like I said, this is just highlighting issues and challenges that we've seen across the sites, and it's not an easy answer nor an easy fix. Continuing on to the next slide, I'm going to hand it back over to Rob for the lead regulator policy memo.
Okay, get my webcam started back up. So you may or may not have heard of this, but there's a 1997 lead regulator, let me change this slide here, policy for cleanup activities at federal facilities that are on the NPL, and its goal is very much like the FFA. We're trying to eliminate duplication and streamline cleanup processes through appointing a lead regulator. It's geared toward federal facilities when most states are signing the FFA as equal partners, and some states express the interest in being the lead oversight agency over certain pieces of the cleanup. So within an FFA, they may want to do certain pieces of the cleanup. They may want to do most of the cleanup. They may only want to do one smaller site that they were already working on before the NPL listing or something like that. So what it allows us to do is set up who the primary regulatory agency is that oversees the cleanup work at a specific operable unit, and most NPL sites are broken up into multiple operable units, an area of contamination, or just the entire NPL site. So this whole lead regulator idea allows the identification of a lead regulator, and like I said before, it's supposed to minimize the multiple regulator review and comment, reduce the number of redundant and sometimes competing oversight processes. And I know for some of our DOD and DOE partners, this is music to their ears, that they only get to hear from one agency and they only have to meet the demands of one agency. So that is something that can be done in certain cases. And also one of the things it does is enable us to say, look, states, you have some of your own programs that are authorized either under RCRA or another state cleanup authority. And in some cases, you handling a certain federal facility is better under that program or just as good, and therefore we're going to say that this piece of the site or this site is going to be led by the state regulator. So it's supposed to streamline oversight arrangements. So if there are state-led cleanups for portions of the site that's under a RCRA-authorized state program, EPA is going to be very minimally involved. We're going to rely on the state to do the oversight work and to work with the lead agency, the federal facility, to develop a remedial alternative that EPA can agree with on minimal review. It does still require EPA to list the site on the NPL, when it comes time to delete the site, EPA has to do that, and we have to adhere strictly to CERCLA 120G and 120H. So here you're talking about certain pieces of the CERCLA statute that cannot be delegated. So we have to be careful about that when we set up these arrangements and set up another lead regulator other than EPA. And in this case, when we do this, we usually have some piece of the site that is EPA-led under CERCLA. It might have the minimal state involvement. So then you don't have the state very involved as you go through the investigation and evaluating alternatives and picking a remedy under those portions that are purely EPA lead under CERCLA. So it's kind of a two-edged knife. Remember that. It's you know, EPA minimally involved as you go through the process with the state being the lead, or EPA being the lead with the state being minimally involved. And then when it does come to transferring property under 120H, we just have not, we don't delegate that, so EPA will still have to be involved. And a lot of these facilities, once they get to a place where they're clean, or even before they're completely clean, they may want to transfer things. Well, EPA is still very, very involved in that and has to be according to CERCLA 120H. All right, now community involvement under these agreements, under this lead regulator policy, means, well, normally the federal-led sites require the federal lead agency to be responsible for providing community involvement. So if you're a DOD site or a DOE site or a postal service site, whatever kind of site you are, it's your job as the lead agency to set up all that community involvement. But you have to do it as CERCLA says you have to do it. So you have to do the proper public notices. You have to have the proper public meetings or provide the opportunity for those public meetings if requested. You know, every decision that you make has to be shared with the public and let them have input to it. But it's really the federal agency's job to do that, that runs that site. For state-led sites under this policy, the state lead is, as the regulator still has to make sure that the onus is on the federal facility itself to do all of that community involvement work. However, they should work to promote the input from communities. It's really the state's job to make sure the communities are getting the input they deserve and they need, and that the federal facility is listening to them. And then if there are any changes because we're integrating things, you know, make sure the community is aware of that. Let's see. And then there's this part in here in this policy where if you're entering into a lead regulator agreement that's not in the existing FFA, so it's something you've done after the FFA has been signed, and then you're signed to break up the site in a different way, then you've got to public notice that lead regulator agreement, just like you public notice the FFA. So let's do another one of these little quizzes about applying your understanding. So what are the benefits of a lead regulator, which include the following? So answer correctly the ones that identify where identifying a lead regulator has some benefits. A, minimizing multiple regulator review and comment. B, reducing the number of redundant and competing oversight processes. C, enables the states to oversee sites on a federal facility using a state program authorized under RCRA or another state cleanup authority. And D, allows the state to list sites on the MPL, make final deletion decisions, and adhere to CERCLA 120G and H. So basically you're saying the state would be the lead for CERCLA 120G and 120H. Looks like most of the responses are coming in. There's a few still coming. Okay, I could slow down there, just about set. So the correct answers are A, B, and C. The benefit of identifying a lead regulator under this lead regulator policy is to minimize the multiple reviews and comments and reduce the number of redundant or competing oversight processes. And then it does enable the state to oversee a site on a federal facility. using their own programs, either under RCRA or their own state promulgated cleanup authority. However, we cannot, and as I said earlier, delegate the 120G and 120H. So it's still up to EPA to make that final deletion decision, and when it comes to transferring property, that's still EPA's responsibility to do that. Not that the state's not involved in those things. They certainly are, and we're certainly talking to the states as we go through that, but we can't delegate that authority.
Awesome. Thank you, Rob. Hey, so before we go on to our next piece of guidance that we were going to review, we have a couple of questions that come in. So first question, can an FFA be revised? And the answer to that is yes, a federal facilities agreement can be revised. It can be challenging depending on the scope of the changes. It usually involves negotiations from all the signatories of that document to agree on the changes. And in my experience, it's taken a lot of legal discussion, a lot of just back and forth, really depending on what the nature of the changes. Relatively minor changes that are just updating processes, that might be easier to do, but if you really want to change a major portion of your FFA, I would be ready for a long, long effort. What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, so remember within a federal facility agreement, we actually define minor modifications and major modifications in most of them, and so updating the annual schedule, which in most federal facility agreements is either a separate site management plan or an appendix to the FFA, that's usually considered a minor modification. So it's done very regularly, and it's agreed to by the three FFA managers as identified by the three agencies or two agencies that have signed the FFA. So that's a change that's made almost on an annual basis that most people just take for granted and don't even think about it, but that is a minor modification to your federal facilities agreement. And then I've been involved in major modifications where we brought in parts of the site that had not been originally agreed to be cleaned up, or we added major operable units that had not been listed in the original FFA, and that was considered a major modification. And, yeah, then you got to step up usually to that senior executive committee level, which for EPA is usually a regional administrator, usually the top site manager for the federal facility, and often a commissioner or assistant secretary or something like that within the state for environment, and they have to agree to modify it. Sometimes this comes from the result of a dispute. Sometimes you get to a dispute and part of the resolution is, well, we're going to modify the federal facilities agreement to put this wording in there for this certain situation, and that can be a major modification. So it just depends on how it comes about. Sometimes three parties just agree to do one, and sometimes it's a dispute, and then there are the everyday modifications that happen. I call them everyday, but the annual schedule modifications. So it's certainly possible to modify a federal facility agreement. They're not written in stone, but you know, we don't usually go back and play around with like what everybody agrees to as what the site is, and you know, we don't change very often. These were the primary documents that were listed originally, and you know, this is the RCRA Circle Integration Clause. Those sorts of things are pretty pro forma. They just stay. But the working pieces as we work through the process, and you know, some of these FFAs were signed back in the late 80s. They've been around a while, and things have changed on facilities. And you know, sometimes we have to change things to address those realistic changes in the project. So they're not written in stone. You can make changes to them. You don't want to get too willy-nilly with those changes, or you start changing things and then you start losing track of them. But they are not immutable, I guess is one way to put it.
Thanks, Rob. So we have another question. How does the DSMOA fit into an FFA or CERCLA process? So I'm racking my brain really quickly for that's Department of Defense State Memorandum of Agreement, I believe is the acronym. And Rob, jump in if I got that wrong. From what I understand, that's really an agreement between the states and DOD, on getting funding for doing CERCLA work or CERCLA review work. You want to jump in on that, Rob?
Yeah, So most of the DSMOA agreements came around after FFAs were signed. So in general, they weren't even thought of to be mentioned in FFAs. And since that time, when we have signed FFAs with them, you know, they are a two-party agreement. They're usually between the state and actually it's usually the Corps of Engineers that implements them for Department of Defense. And so EPA is not involved in them. We don't sit down and negotiate how much money DOD should be giving the states and how much work the states should be doing for that money. So they don't really fit into the FFA. However, there is the reality that a lot of the work done under DSMOA sites that are NPL sites and have a federal facility agreement, you are claiming work that you're doing on that federal facility under the FFA for your DSMOA, as you rightfully should be, because it is Department of Defense work. But in general, EPA stays out of that, and it's an agreement between the state and the Department of Defense. And I've even had a couple of states tell me flat out, we don't really want you involved. And that's fair because we're not a signatory to that agreement, so it's really a DOD and state thing. And I've never seen one worked into an FFA. I'd be interested with all these people on the line here if anybody's ever seen one worked into an FFA. I have had the conversations about, hey, we're not getting the funding to work on those particular sites, so we're not too concerned about them being in the schedule for this year or next year as a result. And the opposite of, hey, we're working on these sites, but they're not showing up in our DSMOA, and so then it becomes a conversation between the state and DOD about making sure they are getting paid for the sites they're working on a DOD facility. And a lot of times EPA is there, you know, we usually meet in three-party meetings, so we're there for those discussions. But usually these DSMOA meetings are really just between DOD and the states.
Okay, final comment, and then we'll keep going with our slides. There's just a statement here. So there's 44 states and territories that are authorized to implement their own RCRA programs in lieu of the federal program. But so just a statement here that in Alaska, EPA implements the RCRA program, not the state. So just for us to consider that when explaining some of these things.
That's an excellent point. And actually, when I first started with the agency back in 91, I think at that time, only two of our eight states were authorized for RCRA corrective action, and so we actually did oversee the corrective action for a number of these Department of Defense facilities, and we weren't a Superfund division back then. We were a waste division that had RCRA and CERCLA both integrated into that division. And so, yeah, I'm familiar that there are times when we are the lead for the RCRA, and we're in the spot of trying to integrate if we have a RCRA permit with what we're doing in CERCLA. And, you know, basically when I was doing it, we did the same sort of things. We would do the lead under CERCLA and do the cleanup work. And then once we signed a ROD and we tried to get a permit modification to capture that, and then we'd also, once we implemented the remedy, we tried to get a permit modification done through the RCRA permit writer in the regions to capture that being accomplished, and that operable unit under CERCLA usually had a solid waste management unit designation under RCRA. So, yeah, EPA has to do that themselves, and it sounds like in Alaska we're still doing that. But we did do it for a lot of the states through the 80s and into the early 90s. But then after a certain point, almost all the states did get the corrective action authority.
All right. So let's continue on with the next memo we're going to discuss, and that's improving RCRA CERCLA coordination at federal facilities. And this is a 2005 memo that really reiterated the points of the previous policies that we've discussed so far today, avoiding duplication of work, considering deferral, early coordination, and it was aimed to address issues at federal facilities where overlapping RCRA and CERCLA procedural requirements and regulatory regimes are applicable. So we've gotten better. You know, 2005, we had the earlier memos from the mid-90s. And in 2005, really just reiterating, okay, we still want to make sure we're being as effective as we can with time and resources. It's really important to identify what all those requirements are up front so that they can be planned for. And again, remember, our FFAs have those specific clauses talking about what's under RCRA, what's under CERCLA, specifically trying to address this point. But the best thing you can do is plan ahead. When you fail to plan ahead, well, you're planning to fail, right? So exit strategies, we want to get to done. So when we're looking at RCRA and CERCLA integration clauses for those FFAs that are designed to identify requirements of each program, that's really to make sure that we can minimize duplication wherever possible. But there were some instances where states were speaking out saying, well, we want to require corrective action closeout steps in addition to those under CERCLA. And there was an opinion that the state RCRA process allowed for more public involvement in the context of property transfer. So any time that a federal property is going to be considered to be transferred to another group, there's a lot of things that need to be considered, particularly if there's going to be any waste left in place, and how that may affect the ability to transfer that property in the future is something you want to be planning for as far as exit strategies go. So let's talk a little bit more about that property transfer topic. So some states requested that the RCRA permits be modified and RCRA corrective actions be closed out in accordance with state and EPA guidance approaches, even when the cleanup was being done under CERCLA. So that, when it comes to property transfer, can result in a lot of uncertainty. We're done with CERCLA, but you're not done with RCRA. Can this land be transferred to another group? Or, you know, what's the problem here? So being sure to integrate a facility's RCRA closeout process with the property transfer process in mind can really help minimize those additional delays and costs. Is appropriate public involvement being done? Are there other needs that have to be met? Can we plan in up front in the beginning of the planning process so that the exit strategy is clear, that we were avoiding that bottleneck towards the end of a process, having those long delays when perhaps there's a potential, you know, beneficial reuse for that land or an interested party who could make something of it. So something to keep in mind. All right. So we've given a lot of discussion on the different memos that are out there, policies that apply, but we'd like to give you some real-life examples with case studies of how CERCLA and RCRA have been integrated at federal facility sites. So I'd like to hand it over to Anna. We're going to pull up her slides. And Anna, do you want to introduce yourself and then tell us about your case study?
I'd love to. Hi, Amy. Hi, everyone. Amy, I'm going to try my webcam. While we're pulling up, my name is Anna Cornelius, and I am a relatively new remedial project manager here in Atlanta. And this is one of the first sites that I typically hand to new hires, simply because it has a very interesting hydrogeology. It's complex. But most importantly, something that I think is the reason why this case study was selected was because we have a very involved partnering team at MCLB. It's definitely one where you will learn everything about federal facility agreements. And being a new RPM, oftentimes you're just handed a folder and you're told, here's your FFA. And how many of us actually go through it? We kind of gloss through it to kind of get familiar with the site, but we don't really go into the nuts and bolts. And I had to learn how to do this because of my involvement at MCLB Albany. And so this is what we're hoping we get to share with you all in this case study, that federal facility partnering, where you're talking about RCRA integration, CERCLA integration, they certainly do come in handy. And as you'll see in this case study, hopefully if I do a good job with delivering the message, you'll see that it'll actually be a good benefit to you. Also, as an introduction, Rob Pope, remember I told you that this site was handed to new hires typically, but this was Rob Pope's site some time ago. He handed it over to another RPM, who handed over to another RPM. I'm not sure to tell your age, Rob. And then it was handed down to me. So Rob may come in and interject, and certainly we will take a couple of questions after the case study, should you have any. So, you know, I love, like, quick and simple and take-home messages. And so I may be a little bit too simple, but I hope it's just to kind of give you the point that No, we're talking about sites, and we're talking about site boundaries. This is the site boundary for MCLB Albany. And as you see, it's a red box. But one thing we kind of forget when we talk about managing our oversight authority is it's not just a site boundary. That boundary, that red box, is also supposed to kind of be your barrier to say, this is where the contamination needs to end. This is where it needs to stop. And any time it crosses over that red box or that line or whatever you like to envision it as, for this site we're going to call it the red box, that's supposed to kind of give you a flag. And you're supposed to go into your toolbox as soon as you kind of see something creeping up on that boundary or that red box. You're supposed to kind of start making some preventative measures and say it cannot cross over. And what we did at MCLB is we didn't really do that too well. In our case studies, we'll talk further. We had some issues with that red box, and we got so far over that, unfortunately, we had to pull out some cards where RCRA really came in to support us on that. So I took this screenshot from Google Earth because I was just fearful of technical issues, but this is a screenshot of the site. And the point of me bringing this is to show you that if you could look, you'll see that it's a whole bunch of military cars, the tanks, the trucks, the jeeps, and that's essentially what the purpose of this site is to conduct maintenance and repairs on military vehicles and large equipment. And so it serves as a maintenance depot, and it still does do that. Actually, it's one of the most active sites that I have. It has holds approximately 3,600 civilians and enlisted officers. And because of the activities that are done there at the site, such as paint thinning, repairs, burying of waste, as you can imagine, this is why we have this as a hazardous waste site. We've had contamination in the groundwater. We have contamination in the soil. And we also had some cases where we had contamination in the sediments. Our contaminants of concern there are largely your PCEs and its derivatives, as well as carbon tetrachloride and its derivatives. We do have quite a few metals and PCBs. So as a result of these, the nature and extent of contamination that we identified in the soil, the groundwater, and the sediment, the site was placed on the National Priorities List in 1989. And to facilitate in the management of the cleanup efforts, we signed an FFFA in 1991. And the FFA, as I mentioned earlier in the discussion, is actually very critical to the efforts in getting this site cleaned up because it was actually a very well-written one, because it really does go into a great depth of conversation about integrating RCRA into the circular activities. And so we'll talk more about that in a second. But to further support in the cleanup, we parsed out the site into 32 potential sources of contamination, which are just really isolated areas where the contamination resides, so we don't have to worry about tackling all 3,600 acres of the site. And in that, we identified 32 of those. 15 are addressed under CERCLA efforts, while the remainder are addressed under RCRA and various programs. The 15 CERCLA PSCs are managed under 6 operable units. And you know, the thing about MCLB that's so interesting is we have so much to be proud of. We were able to execute 8 decision documents to support in the selection of the most appropriate remedies to address that contamination at the site. But we were also able to achieve construction complete within maybe 20 years of issuing all those rods. So that was pretty impressive. But we're now trying to get to achieving site ready for anticipated reuse. And we're hitting a big snag because of this groundwater contamination issue, which serves as kind of the basis of our discussion today for this case study. We're having this off-site migration of the groundwater contamination, and as a result, it's putting a hindrance on us achieving that SWIRU target. So quick and dirty, this is a table that summarizes all of our PSCs and the associated operable units. And it's 2 take-home points here. One, it shows the progress. If you count, you say, Anna, there are not 6 operable units here. You're missing 2. And there are not 15 CERCLA PSCs here. You're missing 3. You're right. those operable units and PSCs have been removed off of our list because they've been cleaned up. That's huge, right? But the yellow highlighted discussions that are in the table, which all coincide with operable unit 6, that's where we're having our issues. And right here you'll see in our description the three groundwater plumes that are part of our groundwater effort: the northern plume area, the depot maintenance activity, and the warehouse disposal area. For purposes of today's case study, we're going to focus solely on this NPA groundwater plume. So what's really going on with this NPA groundwater plume, and why are you talking about having these challenges? Well, you know, according to the 2001 Record of Decision, which focuses on the management of groundwater contamination, we selected a remedy that we thought was going to be pretty effective, and that was to inject chemicals into the groundwater, and those chemicals included potassium permanganate and zero-valent iron. And the way the route was written, which is pretty clever, was to say, you know, listen, we know that chemical injections are not always the most effective way if you do just one round. We understand that you need to do multiple rounds. So the ROD was written to allow flexibility for additional injections to be done until the partnering team felt that the remedy was performing as anticipated, or until we decided that, hey, it's not working, we need to select another remedy. And so because of that, the remedy was followed with some supplemental efforts, such as implementing LUX, and then following monitoring nitrogen attenuation and long-term monitoring. And all of these efforts were to achieve ultimately the final goal, which is to achieve cleanup goals so that the groundwater could be restored to beneficial use. So remember the red box. Now, unfortunately, in this diagram, it's now a black box, but you get my drift. It's still the site boundary. And in this sketch, we have the green boxes. These denote your 15 CERCLA PSCs. And we have these red dashed circles. These are your groundwater plumes. And remember, for purposes of today's discussion, we're focusing solely on the NPA sources. So here we are. We're talking about the NPA. We're back with our red box here, the site boundary. And here you have your plume, the NPA plume. Here is the other two. Here are the other two plumes that are mentioned. But again, we're only focused on this one. And now you see the extent of our issue here. The plume is not within that red box. That plume has extended over that red box into an orange box, which is a privately owned landfill, which we call Maple Hill Landfill. And this diagram was presented to the partnering team. Oh, goodness. I'm going to keep talking. I'm on slide, okay, because my connection just got lost. I am on slide. Okay, it's coming back. With the offsite groundwater migration plume. I'm going to restart my webcam. I apologize. Okay. And for those of you who may have lost connection, I believe we are on slide 9. So if you need to get caught up, slide 9. So here you see we've gone into this private property. And in the private property, the partner team was presented this sketch back in 2011, 2010. So we're talking about over 10 years, it's been a continuing issue. And what happened was the partner team looked at this and said this is unacceptable. First of all, the plume is not even fully delineated. Secondly, we're now going over the site boundary, which means that perhaps the remedy is not effective, it's not working the way it's supposed to be working. Thirdly, we're now going into a privately owned property that's something we don't want to deal with. And because, fourthly, you've now expanded the universe of our LUX. And so we just didn't understand why the Navy just wasn't being more proactive and more aggressive in addressing these issues. And so this started the 10-year discussion with the partnering team about how we can be a better effective manager of this groundwater contamination plume, and how we can ensure that we can be good partners and good neighbors to our citizens. So the way how things started hashing out, we had partner meeting after partner meeting after partner meeting. The Navy brought in its groundwater expert to tell us that it's nothing to do with that they don't find it to be important. The problem is, and all of us that deal with federal facilities can understand this, is that money gets tight. And unfortunately, when you're having to compete up against more involved sites that have more receptors that are in a higher level of exposure, those have to take precedence over those like MCLB, where it's just a landfill across the street. It's not a daycare. It's not a school. And it's not to say that it's minimizing, but it's to say if you're limited in your resources, you do have to prioritize. And so because of that, the partnering team understood the Navy's position, but it still didn't address the fact that we have an unidentified or an uncharacterized plume that steadily crosses the street and going to a private, probably owned property. And so the Navy said, listen, there's absolutely nothing we can do right now until and unless Congress give us more money. So this is kind of where we started shaping things into discussions. This is where we had to become more clever, and the Navy, in return, had to be more clever. This is a pretty good story. We fell back on the foundation. We fell back on the basics. We looked back at the FFA, the state and I, and we looked at all of these provisions that we kind of glossed over in our federal facility agreement, and where it talked about RCRA corrective action can be used as an enforceable tool. And MCLB has a hazardous waste facilities permit that was issued when the site first got listed. Just to kind of draw back some of the contamination, the state went on and put in a RCRA-operated pump and treat system. And that is still a part of the site's background. It's a part of the process. And so that permit is renewed every 10 years. In addition to that, we look back and just kind of realize that we have a very strong partnering team. Because of that, the state felt comfortable to support CERCLA efforts by saying we can pull out some RCRA things. And the reason why the state felt like, hey, CERCLA is great to us is because we did a great job at acknowledging RCRA efforts. And one of our rods, it acknowledged the significance of RCRA process and put that to a kind of equivalent that to CERCLA products. So instead of saying just a rod, that rod also equivalent basically found the equivalent to RCRA, saying this is the equivalent to a RCRA rod. And so that way, you know, sometimes we get lost in the jumble of what document do we use, what's this document from RCRA, and how is that applicable to CERCLA. This rod spelled it out for us very well, and that was something that I thought was very unique that I hadn't seen before. And so that encouraged consistency, and it also allowed for a consistent message to be crossed the table between the state and EPA, which is, your voice is just as important as our voice. No one's voice is more important or less important. So because of this partnering effort that has been established in the FFA and in our rods and just in our everyday communication, the state said, listen, we're ready to pull the wild card here. We're ready to say that, hey, if the Navy is not willing to delineate this plume and take appropriate action, whatever that may be, we're going to go ahead and revoke that permit and take a corrective action on the site. And then we, EPA, was able to follow up and say, well, okay, if you do that, then we'll also say we're going to flag you for off-site migration, which is a big no-no for EPA, and we're also going to flag you in our five-year review by saying, hey, we have an issue here, and you need to address it, Navy. So because of that, the Navy said, well, listen, we're willing to work with you. Okay, you don't have to pull your bluff. We're good. So the Navy said what they'll do is, what they have done, is that they have delineated that plume. We know exactly how far that plume goes off-site. And the Navy also came up with a better suggestion. Listen, if we can't get the funding to do additional chemical injection, let's do this. Let's just say that perhaps the remedy is not effective, and we can reverse the time. We can go back and do a more extensive or a more robust investigation to determine really what is the most appropriate remedy, because we don't think that we identified the correct source to the origin of contamination there at the site. And so the Navy said, we're going to do an engineering study, we're going to roll back the hand of time, we're going to do a full characterization of this plume, and we're going to be able to address this contamination in the most effective and cost-effective manner possible. And because of those efforts, now the partner team is back on track. And so, in summary, your tools don't have to be RCRA versus CERCLA. They need to be integrated. You need to be understanding of what exactly RCRA means. If there's a permit there at the site, understand what those conditions are for the site. If I can address it correctly, the permit that the state was going back on to say, hey, if the Navy decides not to do this delineation and take appropriate action, we're going to get them off of the scenario that you're not protecting human health and the environment. That was the last condition that was specified in that permit to say, if any of these conditions are not met, you can revoke, modify, suspend, or completely cancel this permit. And that's what the state stood on. So understand that verbiage, understand those conditions, because you never know when you have to pull that out to help you out with the circle of related action. So that concludes our case study. We'd like to open it up, Demi. I'm handing it back to you as far as how you want to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anna. That was great. I'm just going to check and see if we have any questions specific to the case study. Again, if you do have one, feel free to type in your question now while I'm looking through our question box. Just one second. All right. I'm not seeing specific questions for the case study, but I will let you know if one pops up. Sometimes it takes a few seconds for that to come through. So we will send those your way, Anna and Rob, if we have questions come in. So we have just one very short case study and one more section to go through, and I'm hoping we can dedicate the rest of time to answer the remaining questions that have come in, because we do have a handful. So let's go ahead and continue on with the slides, and we'll try and get to the questions. So we had that great case study from Anna. Another example I wanted to provide to the group is that of the Hanford site, which is the Department of Energy site. So the FFA at the Hanford site was signed between EPA, the Department of Energy, and the Washington State Department of Ecology back in 1989. There's actually four NPL sites that were listed at Hanford. But what I wanted to talk about with the FFA was that it specifically identifies how RCRA, CERCLA, and the State Dangerous Waste Program overlap and describes how each program will interface to achieve an efficient regulatory program overall. Those are a lot of moving parts. So as you can see here, this is the Hanford site. We have a number, maybe you've heard of them, the Hanford tanks, single shell and double shell tanks filled with mixed radioactive waste. Here in the central part of Hanford, there was a number of nuclear reactors along the Columbia River, primarily being cleaned up under CERCLA. But across the site, there are permitted facilities as well, so a lot of different regulatory programs being implemented. But because it's laid out in the Federal Facilities Agreement, what is going to be cleaned up under which program, that really helps. So for those treatment, storage, and disposal units at the site, the TSDs, those are managed under a permit. And again, as I mentioned, that includes the Hanford single and double shell tanks. So that's all permitted, falling into this space right here, where we have the Washington State Dangerous Waste Program and their authorized program in lieu of the federal RCRA program. For CERCLA, we have CERCLA past practice units. That phrase is specifically identified in the FFA for this site. And it says that, okay, if you have a CERCLA past practice unit or a RCRA CERCLA past practice unit, again, that's referring to cleanup under corrective action terms specifically pulled out of the FFA. In that space, the CERCLA or the RCRA CERCLA approach would be substantial enough to meet the requirements of both programs. So that past practice process, it has to be sufficiently comprehensive to make sure that all the technical requirements are met for both the statutory authorities and respective regulations in this space. Again, we don't want to have to go through the CERCLA process and then go and start a separate corrective action process after the fact. We want those to meet each other's requirements so that we can get to that exit point where cleanup is done. So for Hanford, like I mentioned, the tanks are permitted. There's a very, very large and complex permit for the Hanford site that deals with the tank releases, or the tanks themselves, excuse me. So for if there's any releases immediately below those tanks, and that would be dealt with through RCRA corrective action. And then for contamination that exists further away from the tanks, that is going to be approached through the CERCLA process. So you're not duking out which regulatory authority is going to be used where on the site. That's all laid out in the FFA. So EPA knows its role, the state knows its role, and DOE knows how to work with the regulatory authorities in those cleanups. One thing that's unique about the Hanford Federal Facilities Agreement is that the state is identified as a lead regulator for some of the CERCLA operable units as well. Remember, we talked about that policy for a lead regulator? So in that, having that in mind, the state is actually taking the lead for some of that CERCLA work. And that, again, is unique to Hanford. I'm not sure how many other sites do that, but it's laid out in the Federal Facilities Agreement. And so you don't have to figure it out later. All right, we're going into our last section now. I'll hand it back over to Rob for management of CERCLA remediation waste under RCRA. And this is another memo.
Hello.
Hey.
Okay, so we're gonna talk about management of CERCLA waste. So under CERCLA section 121E, we're not supposed to have to do a permit for an on-site CERCLA response. So that is very important, and that you understand what all of that means. So the way EPA has interpreted CERCLA section 121E is to basically waive the requirement to obtain a permit and any associated administrative or procedural requirements of permits for a CERCLA response that we're doing on-site, but not the substantive requirements that would be applied through permits. So we're not going to fill out paperwork for permits, local or state permits. We're not going to pay any fees for permits. But if one of the requirements, for instance, is, hey, before you do this work, the state or the county would like to see the plan and review it and provide comments, we certainly should be doing that, where we share the plan of this is what we're going to do and take the comments from the state or the county or whatever the municipality is and implement or at least have a good response to the substantive comments. But that's not exactly the same. So if we're doing something that's off the CERCLA site, but taking waste off the CERCLA site, then any requirements through permits have to be dealt with. If we're discharging the waste off the CERCLA site, then we would have to comply with permits that are needed in order to do that. And then there's this great little thing called the off-site rule, which is CERCLA 121D3, and applies to any CERCLA action where we're going to move things off-site to any substance, hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant that is a CERCLA waste. And basically what the off-site rule says is we can only place those in an operating facility that is in compliance with RCRA or another applicable federal or state requirement. So that may be if we're shipping stuff to a publicly owned treatment works for liquid discharge, that we are complying with whatever permit they have to have from the state to give them that material, that give them that liquid discharge, and that what they discharge is going to be in compliance with the permit that they have. And we rely on them to make sure they're complying with their permit once we give them the liquid waste. So RCRA, or it could be an NPDES permit, any kind of permit. And that we're prohibited, let me get to the next bullet here, we're prohibited to transfer to a land disposal facility that is releasing contaminants into the environment as defined by the off-site rule. So there are some definitions in the off-site rule, what it means to be releasing contaminants into the environment. But if you've ever worked on a CERCLA site and you're shipping waste to a Subtitle D or a Subtitle C landfill, or even if it's to another type of facility, you know that facility, you have to check in with the off-site rule coordinator, which in most regions resides in the RCRA division, and make sure that landfill has their off-site rule acceptance. So they haven't had any violations from either the state or from EPA that has made us say, you know what, we're pulling back your off-site rule acceptability. So, and it's our job at EPA to make sure waste is shipped off, and then it becomes DOD or DOE's job if they're the lead agency is going to an off-site rule compatible facility. And you have to find that facility before you decide what your remedy is. And sometimes it has a large impact to your facility and to your remedy, rather, because you may say, well, look, we've got to ship this to an off-site rule compliant Subtitle D landfill. And I have a facility where we're doing this right now. And we looked around, and we thought we had found one that was about 25 miles away. Well, that's a significant distance to truck waste, but it's not horrible. Turns out that they are a Subtitle D facility that never got an off-site rule acceptability, and they weren't really interested in pursuing one. And so we had to go find the next closest one, which was 80 miles away. So now we're trucking waste 80 miles. So that is a much larger expense and makes that remedy look very different than it did when we first started evaluating it, of trucking, of excavating and treating and then disposing off-site. So those things do play an important role into what remedy you choose and how you move forward. We also have this concept at EPA called the area of contamination, the AOC, and RCRA allows certain discrete areas of generally dispersed contamination to be considered RCRA units. So normally we think about a landfill like this, there's all kinds of different contamination that goes into a landfill, and the whole landfill is a RCRA unit. But an AOC in CERCLA world, an area of contamination in CERCLA world, is equated to that RCRA land-based unit, where we say, all right, we have an area of contamination, and a lot of times this is an operable unit within these large federal facilities, and we say all of this area is contaminated, and what we're going to do with our remedy is we're going to consolidate this waste, and we're going to do some in-situ treatment within our area of contamination. And that does not create a new point of hazardous waste generation as far as purposes of RCRA. It also avoids triggering any land disposal restrictions, so we no longer have to worry about land disposal restrictions because we're not picking up the waste and moving it to a whole new place. We're just consolidating with our area of contamination. And as you might know, a lot of these federal facilities, the area of contamination for an operable unit can be quite large. It can be acres and acres. So if we can consolidate it down to just a couple of acres where we're treating it and or capping it, then we can really have a big effect over many acres, but really only leave waste in place in one part of that AOC. And at the same time, not have to trigger land disposal restrictions because we picked up waste and put it back down. There's also the idea of corrective action management units. These are more of a standard RCRA management unit that we see at RCRA facilities, and they're called CAMUs for short. That's the acronym. CAMUs do not have to meet LDR treatment standards either, so they don't have to meet that universal treatment standard for their different contaminants. However, they do differ from an AOC in that the waste may be treated ex situ and then placed in a CAMU. So CAMUs may be located in an uncontaminated area at the facility, and you can consolidate into a CAMU from areas that are not contiguously contaminated, so that are really outside of what we would call area of contamination. CAMUs are a little more rigorous, not rigorous, but sometimes a little more difficult because they have to be approved by EPA, and that means basically by the RCRA part of EPA, or an authorized state. So now you're bringing in your state RCRA program to make sure that the CAMU you're building to deal with CERCLA waste is an authorized CAMU. Then they have to be designated in the permit or a corrective action order. So this is more steps and more things to be accomplished in order to use a CAMU in comparison to the area of contamination concept. Let me go back to that just for a second. So in comparison, that AOC concept says you can consolidate within all of your area of contamination, which could be a whole operable unit, and then you can do in situ treatment. But you don't trigger LDR. You don't have to get a RCRA permit or authorization through a RCRA order from the state or from the EPA RCRA folks. And whereas a CAMU, you do have to do those things. but it has the advantage of you can pick up the waste and treat it, ex situ, and then put it back in the CAMU. So that they have some competing requirements or not, or a lack of requirements, but also some advantages for CAMUs that you don't have for the area of contamination concept. Okay, so that gets us through all of our slides. And now just a quick summary of everything that we covered. Federal facilities with both operating facilities are subject to RCRA, and past practice sites may be subject to both CERCLA and RCRA corrective action. So almost all of the large federal facilities that we deal with have active permits for RCRA and other environmental acts. And so those facilities are operating facilities that are subject to those. And they still have to comply with those even though they're an MPL site. So that is just something to always keep in mind, that they have those permits and they have to comply with them. They're not really part of our FFA process or our CERCLA process. They are standalone. Placement on the MPL doesn't preempt state enforcement, and states may enforce their own hazardous waste laws at CERCLA sites. So if there is a hazardous waste facility within an MPL site and they have a violation, then the state definitely can enforce against that. And it's not part of the FFA. It's not part of the FFA negotiations or the site management plan of when they're going to get to it. It is separate under their state permit. Remedial programs should coordinate to minimize any duplication of effort and second guessing of remedial decisions. And really, this is very key. You know, I think Anna's example is a great one, where the team working together with DOD and the state and EPA could not find a way to move things forward quickly under the FFA processes. And so they fell back to where the state has authority that's in addition to the FFA, and said, look, if you can't do it here, if the Navy and the Marines aren't going to prioritize this, we're going to use our other options to help you understand that you need to prioritize this. So, you know, you want to do that when you have to, but what you really want to do, what would have been much better from EPA's perspective, is if the Navy and the Marines had recognized at that site, yes, we have to do this, and we can do it under our FFA process, and we are going to do it. But it's always good to have the regulators go, all right, if you're not going to do it under here, you still have to do it, and we're going to use a different way to get there. But we want to try to avoid that second guessing if we can. And then program deferral, which we talked a little bit from that 1997 policy, I think, can be a very efficient way for both CERCLA and RCRA to address overlapping cleanup requirements. So that is a really good point to talk about some more and think about within your own programs. And some FFAs already have this, where there are pieces of the site broken out and the state manages those pieces of the site, and EPA is really just not involved until it comes to the very end and it's time to get rods issued and sites deleted and things like that. And then EPA wants to be able to, or has to, because we can't delegate that, look at it and go, okay, this is great. You met CERCLA requirements, and through that you met RCRA requirements, rather, and through that you've also met the CERCLA requirements.
Awesome. Thank you, Rob. So I want to dedicate about the next 10 minutes that we have together to answer some of the questions that came in, because there were quite a number. First question was looking at environmental indicator status. So we didn't really talk about environmental indicators on this webinar, but on April 6th, we will have a performance measures and environmental indicators webinar that will really get into how they differ between RCRA and CERCLA and how those determinations are made. So if you're interested in that topic, I highly recommend that you register for the April 6th webinar. There was also a question, Rob, what site in Region 4 does not have an FFA signed?
It is currently the Redstone Arsenal, which is a Department of Army site that we have not signed the FFA. And it's a very unique situation. That site is basically a round donut, and we have a donut hole in the middle of that site that is called Marshall Space Flight Center, that's run by NASA. Was formerly the Army. actually has a signed FFA. But the surrounding donut, which is a much larger piece of property, and of course the donut hole, you know, if we have things released from the donut hole, they're going out into the donut, does not have an FFA. So that is certainly one we're continuing to work with and trying to work into a situation where we do have a reasonable solution there.
Great. So there was another question. I have an NPL site where the Forest Service owns land within the site boundaries. Will an FFA be required once EPA completes the RAFS for that operable unit of the site? So you're sharing that it's an NPL site. The Forest Service owns part of it. I'm wondering if it's a federal facility site or a mixed ownership site. There's a couple of questions. If it is a federal facility site on the NPL, then yes, you would need to issue that interagency agreement, the FFA, within 180 days after review of the RIFS. Typically, those are signed before that point in time, but if you read the regulations, it specifies it has to be within 180 days of review of that RIFS document. So I hope that answer helps, but there are a couple of question marks as to whether or not this is a federal facility site. Rob, did you have other thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I mean, we have a number of sites where DOD is a PRP or another agency is a potentially responsible party, and the site is owned by a private entity, but at some point either Department of Defense or some other agency contributed to the waste stream, and so they are a PRP, and then they have to work it out with the other PRPs, how much they're paying for, things like that, just like any multi-PRP site. But this sounds like it might be a little different where they actually own the property, and so we might look at that one a little differently. There are some FUDs the government doesn't own the property anymore, but it was a formerly utilized defense site, and so we hold the Department of Defense liable to clean up that site for the portions that they were shown to need to clean up. So it'd be hard to figure this one out without knowing a lot more. You know, if they own the property but they leased it to someone else and that other entity is the one that caused the contamination, well, the Forest Service is a property owner, so by the rules of CERCLA, they are a PRP, but they may not be the majority PRP that is responsible for the waste, and so we would go after the private PRP just as much as we would the Forest Service's owner. So it looks like it's a little mixed. It's hard for me to tell just from that information which way we'd go. So you might need an FFA, but you might not. They might just be a PRP within your consent order.
Right. Thanks, Rob. There was another question on munitions, and we really didn't touch on munitions in this webinar, but I do want to let you know, as part of the Federal Facilities Academy in September of this year, we will have a munitions webinar. So you can register for that already on the CLUIN website. So I know that's a ways off, but that would be the best opportunity to ask questions on munitions. We'll have all our in-house experts on the phone or on the webinar, so to speak, to answer your specific questions there. There's another question on how does the NERDA process affect the rest cleanup decisions made in CERCLA or RCRA? So we didn't get into NERDA, but typically, you know, CERCLA progresses with looking at risk-based decisions for cleanup to protect human health and the environment in parallel to the NERDA process, but they're not necessarily a joint effort, though they do inform, like the CERCLA cleanup obviously will provide information that will inform the NERDA process, but they are separate processes. Rob, do you have other thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I've had to deal with this a good bit, actually. So it's important to remember, whether it's a private site or a federal facility, that EPA is not a natural resource trustee, and so we're not actually allowed to get too involved in the NERDA process. So what we tend to try to do is get the trustees involved as we go through the remedial investigation and do an ecological risk assessment, because this is almost always an ecological thing, although sometimes it's a fish consumption issue for a couple of the trustees, a human health fish consumption. But so we try to get them involved, and so we're taking their concerns under consideration in trying to move forward that way. But the NRDA and the NRDA process does not really affect it. It's just trying to make those two things that, that really don't match up as much as we can, and being careful for EPA. You know, we're not a trustee. We're not allowed to get any of those funds back when there's a settlement. It's not our job to decide how those funds will be spent or anything like that. And sometimes NRDA will find that, all right, you made a cleanup that was protective of human health and the environment under CERCLA, but we still see damages to the environment over the long period of time that we want some, damages paid for so that we can do other things to enhance the environment there. So, yeah, you have to be careful. That's not our process, and Congress gave us very little role in it. But we just try to work with the trustees as much as possible. And, you know, it's been my personal experience that sometimes when you don't have the right ecological risk assessment support in your house at EPA, that some of these folks from NOAA and Fish and Wildlife, they are great resources for us for that ecological risk assessment. So sometimes it can be a very synergistic relationship to have the NRDA people involved.
Great. So here's another question. I was under the impression there was some recent changes to US EPA approach to transfers under 120H. Is it still a US EPA decision always? So I think this question might be referring to the determinations for OPS, remedies that are operating properly and successfully. So recently EPA issued a revised memo that spoke to this. For non-NPL sites, EPA, having not been involved thoroughly in the cleanup process for those sites, is not going to be making OPS determinations for property transfer purposes in those cases. And the original guidance that came out wasn't as clear on the NPL versus non-NPL and EPA's role in those. So there, a clarification memo was recently issued that said for non-NPL sites, EPA, we just don't have the time and resources to go and make those determinations at sites where we haven't been heavily involved. I hope that answers your question. I think that might be what you're referring to. So looking at time, folks, I think we might have time for one more question. I'll look quickly here to see if we've gotten anything else come in. There's actually quite a few. I apologize. I don't think we're going to be able to get through all of these today, but thank you so much for the interest. It was great being able to answer these questions. I hope we've addressed some of those gaps for you. I think we're getting ready to wind down here for today. So I just want to remind everyone our contact information is on the screen for Rob and myself. Again, I'm Emmy Liha with our FIFRO group. If you have any questions or want to reach out to us, please feel free to do so. And I'd also like to highly encourage you all to fill out the feedback forms. And if you have any suggestions on things to change or how to improve this webinar, please let us know. We're always looking for opportunities for improvement and would love to hear from you. So I'm going to hand it over to Abe to do some of the housekeeping, tidying up for this webinar.
Thanks, Emmy. I just want to say thank you also for joining us today, and please join us again next month at our next FIFRO Presents webinar, which will be on March 3rd, resolving issues before a formal dispute. Today's webinar, as well as the previous webinars in this series, are available in the Cluin archive. There's the website right there. Today's webinar will be available in the archive in about a week, usually less, and the previous ones are currently on there. They're available for your viewing right now. And other than that, as Emmy said, I'd just like to remind you all that please fill out a feedback form. Let us know how the seminar went. That feedback is very important for us to continue putting out quality webinars for you guys. And also, by filling out a feedback form, you will be able to receive a certificate of participation. Slides for this webinar are currently available for download on the webinar registration page that you used to sign on today. And with that, I will formally close today's webinar and thank you all for participating. Thank you.